둘, 셋, 파!
For Hey Army and fellow music fans, I'm Kayla.
And I'm Bethany, and we're the hosts of Standing BTS from the Consequence Podcast Network. We're a bi-weekly show that covers the impact and legacy of K-pop group BTS.
We mix the perfect blend of research and fangirl as we take a deep dive into lyrics during album reviews, theorize over music videos, and keep up with their current events.
No BTS topic is off limits. We welcome everyone into the conversation, whether you're a casual fan, committed ARMY, or someone who's just curious about one of the biggest music groups in the world.
Come chat with us every other Thursday with a new episode wherever podcasts are found.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Hey, and welcome to another edition of Kyle Meredith With. It's the interview series presented by WFPK at WFPK.org, Consequence and the Consequence Podcast Network. Thanks for making your way here, for checking out the episode. Do hit that subscribe button while you're hanging around. If you're not already, you're going to get new interviews just like this one sent your way every single week at Spotify, Apple Podcast, NPR, WFPK.org, Consequence, YouTube for the video versions, or anywhere you get your podcast from. You can subscribe to Kyle Meredith With. And please do give this series a rating and leave a review while you're at it. Of course, we've had some great guests drop by lately. We just talked with Mary Chapin Carpenter and Trampled by Turtles. Marty Stewart looked back at an interview with the late Justin Townes Earl. Ian Astbury of the Cults dropped in. Colin Hay of Men at Work and Bruce Coburn. Elvira herself, Cassandra Peterson. I also caught some time with Olivia Allen Lynn. You can see her starring in Wayward on Netflix. Jeff Tweedy of Wilco was just here. We discussed the movie The Senior with actors Michael Chiklis, Rob Corddry, and Mary Stuart Masterson, as well as The Wrong Paris with Hannah Stocking, Madison Pettis, and Yvonne Orji, and legendary actor Willem Dafoe with Corey Hawkins drop by to talk about The Man in My Basement. That's what you can get when you subscribe to the Kyle Meredith With podcast. That's me, Kyle Meredith. Today, it's going to be a special rewind episode. I'm going to look back at my interviews with Kevin Drew of Broken Social Scene and Sadie Dupuis of Speedy Ortiz. Now, Kevin Drew, of course, who co-founded Broken Social Scene, that sprawling Canadian indie collective that accidentally became the blueprint for every millennial art rock ensemble with too many guitars and feelings. He spent two decades turning chaos into catharsis from You Forgot It in People to his own solo records. And that's what we're going to start. In fact, this interview goes back to 2017 when Broken Social Scene were releasing their first record at that point in like 7 years. Now, of course, Broken Social Scene, basically a Canadian supergroup with Kevin Drew, Brandon Canning, Feist. You got members of Stars and Metrics in there. And so what we got to talk about was finally getting back together to do the Hug of Thunder LP. And Kevin and I got to talk about playing Manchester with Johnny Marr the day after the Paris attacks, which is a very heavy thing, and stories behind some of the songs on the record. So that's where we're going to start in this special rewind episode, heading back to 2017 to talk about Broken Social Scene's Hug of Thunder. It's Kyle Meredith with Kevin Drew of Broken Social Scene.
How are you?
I know we've all been like greedy little fans for a few years now of the gimme, 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 but Hug of Thunder, you knocked it out of the park with this.
Well, that's nice to hear.
Is it harder to make a Broken Social Scene record these days, or is it just not the focus as much as it used to be?
It's not harder. It's just we slowly had to find our way back into doing it, and we had to sort of get everyone on board with fact that we were doing it without sort of pushing or asking. We knew we had a lot of time to sort of take our time to see what we wanted to make and figure out what we were doing together and just slowly get back into each other's lives while creating melodies that we knew so well. The memory muscle of who we were playing together just kind of kicked right back in. So it sort of became about finding the songs and having those songs excite you and want you to keep moving forward. And that's really what it came down to in terms of continuing and creating this record, was that we just wanted to make sure that the body of work we were recording was guiding us.
I mean, of course, the thing about Broken Social Scene is it's such a unique monster, you know, because of, you know, what type of band that you guys are, the extended family all spread out as you can be at times. And I guess I sort of imagine with the way you all write being something akin to, you know, everybody just sort of drifting in and out of the room once everyone's at, you know, the lake house or whatever.
That's exactly how it was.
How do you find the structure in that? I mean, is it just a fun little, you know, in studio campfire jam session that ends up being awesome?
There's a lot of that, and then there's a lot of just spending time sitting and trying to figure out what songs go where and who should play on what. And a lot of times people would just come into the room and we'd sit down and say, here's a bunch of the ideas that we have. You know, we did a 6-day stretch, I believe, with the horn section, and they just kind of came in, and every song that we play them, they'd say, okay, let's work on that one. Let's not work on that one. And you just give people time and freedom to find what they're looking for melodically within what you've already made. And it just really comes down to a sense of trust and having them there in the first place. And you have so much history with everybody that you always know you're going to land. So it was a curious time at first. And then sort of as the summer kicked in and we were out at the bathhouse by the lake and by the pool and doing all those things, you make it about what the real purpose in the first place is, which is friendship. And through that, you find the song. And that's really what it was.
Do you find with that way that, you know, when the outcome happens, that there's any sort of thread that does make its way through the album, either musically or lyrically?
I do. I very much do. I think that we lyrically, having such different lyricists in the band, we found ourselves in the same sort of spot in life and found ourselves sort of singing about things we could get behind, whether it's Leslie personalizing Hug of Thunder about a story and about living as a youthful young woman out there, and then right down to the comments on society that we wanted to make and trying to talk about the struggle and how do you continue and how do you hold on and how do you stay together through these times. And it was kind of easy because that's exactly what we were doing. So there wasn't really any conversations about how we were going to approach it lyrically. Everyone just sort of has their own freedom of expression. And usually that just means you're lining up. If you spend enough time together, you're just going to line up to what the quest's about. So that's sort of what happened.
It sounds like it's, you know, any other, it's like a conversation you would have at a friend in the kitchen, you know, when you put it that way.
Yeah. Well, there was a lot of kitchen time.
There's always a lot of kitchen time because it's the center of the universe for some.
It
somehow.
Is.
You know, those world events, of course, as the story goes, I think you've said that it sort of started coming together because of the Paris attacks. Is that right?
Well, everyone has their own opinion of why it came together. And recently, Charlie just kept reading that and he said, I don't really want that to be the point of why we got together. We all got together, and this is myself quoting Charles Spearin, because at some point a lot of us were unhappy and wanted to get back to the people and get back to the notion of getting in front of people and playing and seeing if we still had a connection. I think what happened with the Paris attacks is it was very cohesive and in line with our return, and that just sort of sped up the process of us wanting to get back out on stage to get to the people. And that's really what it was. I think in a big group, I've been doing a lot of press and I've been realizing that, you know, this is one opinion out of many, and everyone has their own individual reasons for returning. And though it's cohesive in the little details, there isn't one set thing that got us back. But that for me was kind of major because it hit close to home, and the idea of it was so horrific and such a part of the life that we live that it really sideswiped the notion that could happen. And I think that in doing what you do as a band, you do it for the people who are out there choosing to be in front of you and to celebrate with you and to pay to come and see you and be a part of that. And upon returning, we really, really wanted to honor that the best that we could, because we are a celebratory band. We are an anthemic band. We are a band that wants to be in the room with you, not just to be on the stage, but to be amongst the people. So it definitely gave us purpose within what we were already sort of trying to put together. It just sort of sped up the process.
And we'll be right back right after this.
You know that feeling when your day finally slows down and you just want to relax, unplug, and feel good? That's where Mood.com comes in. They're changing the game, delivering legal THC products right to your door, no shady dealers, and absolutely no medical card required, just good vibes and better sleep, shipped straight from their farm to your couch. From delicious THC gummies, smooth vape pens, to premium THC flower, Mood has it all. And everything's federally legal under the 2018 Farm Bill. Yeah, this isn't some loophole. It's the real deal. Head to Mood.com and use code FIRST20 for 20% off your first order. That's MOOD.com. Find your mood.
Welcome back. It's Kyle Meredith with Kevin Drew of Broken Social Scene.
You know, not to make it the point of this interview at all, but I guess it made it even more notable because I think you guys ended up being one of the first bands to play after the Manchester attacks too, which is just a crummy situation for anybody to be in. Not, you know, no disrespect, obviously, not making light of what everybody else went through, but just to have that part of the story is, you know, what can be said. But
it did take myself a second to register that was something that we were talking about returning after the Paris attacks. And when we start our first real tour, we landed, and you know, 5 hours, 6 hours later, something absolutely horrific happened. But within that horror, we were in a town watching people still moving on with their lives the next day. But we went to the vigil and we went and we felt the energy and we weren't sure if the show was going to continue, and it did. And our audience came out, and to be in that energy is something that none of us have experienced before. And we were all there together doing that. And it's very humbling, and it's very, really wipes away all of the unnecessary of this life. And you find yourself purely focused on wanting to play. Mm-hmm. And the fortunate aspect of Johnny Marr coming out and joining the stage with us was pretty unbelievable. And to be in that venue that night, there's really no words for it in the aspect of watching the crowd and seeing their emotions and being there. But we did say there's no place we'd rather be than here tonight. And we meant it. And we just came out and just played. Wasn't even like we played our sets out, or we just said, no, we just got to go and we got to play. And my father was there. So that was strange to have the old school around while we were trying to figure out what to do. And it just felt kind of comforting. And the audience that night were beyond exceptional and beyond open. And that city was very incredible. It was very encouraging and incredible to be there with them.
Yeah. So, the way you guys have always talked about that, I mean, you bring up the word friendship, and I hear that a lot, especially with this one. And just the positivity that you guys put into the world, I would back you up and say that you were the perfect band for the time and place for that moment.
Well, thank you.
As much as any superhero movie can try to emulate that. I'd also say, be careful, because all you got to do is open the door for Johnny Marr, and he's officially part of the band. Man likes to do that, so.
Well, you know, we've hung out a bunch, and he's been really lovely to me in the last kind of 10 years. I met him through Modest Mouse, and we've had his son come up and play with us before, and he's joined us before. So knowing that he was in town, I've played with him a couple times. He's come through Toronto. So it was planned that he was going to come out and play, but obviously, like so many who were from there, he was very upset, and he sort of just said, I can't do it, Kev. And I understood that. But I think as he saw his town rise up, and as I sent him sort of texts throughout the day, as I sent him sort of footage of the vigil, and knowing that we were going to open with a song like Anthems for a 17-Year-Old Girl, he called about an hour before the show and said, I'm going to come and I'm going to do this. Yeah. And it's something that I'll never forget. And he's an exceptional human being and a legend, but just such a grounded, down-to-earth person that there's no one better.
Yeah.
And it was so beautiful of him to take the stage with us. I will forever be in debt for him giving us that moment.
I will switch gears a little bit. There's no good way to do that from this point.
Go ahead.
To at least hit on the latest single, because Skyline you know, it comes across as simple, especially lyrically. You know, it's sort of that, what do you call that whole thing? You know, the turnaround, you know, it sort of plays in that circle and everything. And I was kind of wondering about the challenge to keep an idea like that interesting over 4 minutes, which you've done.
Well, you know, that was a song, that was the one song that I'm so grateful the guys sort of grabbed from a bunch of songs that I played them, because really this whole record is just ground up, everyone in the room creating from ground up, because we really, upon returning, we really wanted the band to have ownership. And Brendan and Justin had heard this song one night and they wanted to do it, and we did it, and they all brought such fresh sort of love towards it. And then in the mix, we were working with the gentleman, Sean Everett, and he kind of went for that moany drum breakdown, and it just sort of fell into place of guiding us through. There's something very beautiful about repetition and mantras within music. Mm-hmm. And we didn't completely touch upon that with this record, but with Skyline, I'm glad that we did, because sometimes you don't need much. You just sort of need few chords, a few sentences, and you need to repeat things for them to register. And it's sort of my heartfelt song towards the city of Toronto, towards the ladies in my life, towards all the, as Emily Haynes would put it, the memory minefield that is that town for me. And some days I walk through that city and I think about everyone who I don't see anymore, and the people in my life and the relationships. That was kind of what Skyline was about. And I'm glad we captured it.
It wasn't until I started reading about it that I had even realized that it is just, you know, those same lines over and over, because it's just a beautiful song as it is. And like I said, that was sort of the impressive part about the whole thing, is that it works without you completely figuring it out right at the beginning. And then once you do figure it out, you know, it becomes more meaningful. Onion skinned, I believe they call that. So,
never heard that.
Yeah, I love this record, Kevin, and it's been so great to talk to you. Thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it. Thank you for loving it.
Thank you for playing it, and thanks for the support, because we're just trying to get back out there. We're trying to get back to reaching everyone, and it doesn't go by us. We appreciate all the support we're getting, and the teams that are helping us, and the stations that are coming on board, and the interviews and all that. We're here to return. So thank you very much.
You make it easy for us. You do. all right. Have a fun summer, as someone would say in a yearbook. Have a great summer. and we'll see.
Did you sign my yearbook?
You know, stay the same. Never change. Have a nice summer.
Never change, man. Never change. All right. Thank you so much. You take care.
You take care too. Bye.
Bye-bye.
And we'll be right back right after this. Welcome back. It's Kyle Meredith. So the second part of this rewind is with Sadie Dupuis of Speedy Ortiz. Now, I'm going to include two different interviews that I've done with Speedy over the years. I think we've done more than two, but definitely these two. And mostly we talk about Speedy, but of course, Sadie does so much more than that, too. I mean, she's a poet. She's got poetry books out there. She runs the Wax 9 label. She's got her solo electronic records under Sad 13. She's one of the greatest lyricists that I've ever heard, definitely of this generation. And so we're going to start back in 2015. This is when we jumped online to talk about feminism. We talked about politics. We talked Lana Del Rey. We talked about Speedy Ortiz and a lot more. So this is part one of part two of this special rewind episode. Kyle Meredith with Sadie Dupuis of Speedy Ortiz.
All right. We are good.
Yeah, it's the first time I've ever actually done an interview on Skype. So it's nice. I'm happy to finally do this.
Somehow I have like three of these today.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And they're never on Skype.
Right. Well, Foil Deer is fan-freaking-tastic.
Thank you so much.
I'm guessing that that's what most people tell you at this point. I don't know if anybody's actually come up to you and say, man, this album blows.
Yeah. My true friends are just like, this shit is terrible.
But it's great. What I instantly loved about it, like, the music stands out at the beginning. And I know there's been a lot of talk about the music, about the maybe a little retro sound of it, but it's really your lyrics that got me on this. Like, you're an artist who's not afraid to start saying something with the lyrics.
Cool.
And I think, and maybe, I don't know if you agree on me with me here, but like, an artist isn't obligated to use their music as a podium or anything, but it seems like you kind of take that opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how interesting my own life is. So I'd rather have music that has a purpose and maybe could be instigating in some positive way.
Yeah. And when you say instigating, is that like trying to push your audience to start a conversation, or is it just like, this is what I believe, stand with me or don't?
Some combination of the two, I think. I think there's certain politics that I'll just dismiss outright, but I think like a lot of the ideas that the last album introduces are maybe political ideas that haven't come into like the pop cultural lexicon until pretty recently. So many people who are like getting interested in rock music haven't grown up with feminism or thought about it tremendously or thought about how their actions are impactful or erasing of other people's voices. So I think a lot of the lyrics on the album are sort of like subtle ways of introducing those ideas and at least lead in so I can talk about them in interviews.
Because you need something to talk about in interviews.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, I'd even wondered if I should, you know, hit on the whole subject of feminism only because you talked about it so much. And
I mean, I'm happy to talk about whatever.
But. Yeah, well, I only mean that as, you know, is there a point where you start to become almost known about, like, that's your thing? That's that, you know, that becomes your thing. And is that such a bad thing when it's something like this?
I mean, I see so many bands whose, like, big, long feature interview for their album is, like, I have this drug problem, like, I have just too much money to spend on drugs. And I guess I'd rather my thing be, you know, social justice warrioring, as it were, than, like, you know, rich kid gets arrested with drugs. Like, I don't know. I guess I'm sick of reading about bands that, you know, the impetus for an album is something like that or a breakup. But not to say that like drug problems aren't seriously legitimate and a problem, but I'd rather, I don't know. It seems to me that the ways in which lots of our societies ghettoized and denied opportunities and in very real danger all the time is a bit more of a serious subject, and I'd rather dedicate time to that.
Yeah. Do you know how we get past all of it at this point? Like say your lyrics start the conversation. Like, have you figured out, going back, let's say, to feminism as a very specific subject, like, you know, in the world, even in, you know, rock music, like, what's the answer? How is it solved? How do we get there to the promised land?
I don't know. The world's pretty messed up.
It's pretty messed up.
We live in a pretty late capitalist world that I don't know how redeemable it can be. But I think one step is showcasing more kinds of voices that have been denied opportunities. And not that I'm like a poster child for a lot of those voices, but even still, like, you look at festival lineups and women are not represented in the ways that they should be. Very rarely do you see people of color performing in rock bands or, not to say that they're not in rock bands, but those rock bands don't get print or online coverage in the ways that, you know, four white guys do.
Right.
Still. And I think just like greater exposure to a wider array of voices is important to me, at least. So for us, like, whatever tiny platform we have, we try to use towards pointing in the direction of other voices that we think are important. And like, we're sort of, you know, I'm doing like press stuff, but I'm sort of still, it's just like weird. I don't have anything to say about myself so much anymore, but we try to use these things to bring awareness to issues that are important to us.
Yeah.
You know, to raise donations or to point to organizations we think are doing important work.
So. No, I don't think you should downplay yourself in that too, because I mean, that again, that comes back to the platform. You have an incredible record that people are finding, and they're, you know, once they find it, you know, it's that part of digging in a little bit more. I mean,
yeah.
I
mean, so once they find it, I'm like, go here and here and here instead.
Well, I'll say this though, you know, there's a million songs that's released every day, and most of them are completely forgettable, cotton candy or, you know, some variation of that. Like, if you're going to find your favorite band, there has to be a reason why they're your favorite band. I think what you guys are doing is exactly, you know, it's good. That's the culprit. That's, I wish more bands would do that.
Well, cool. Thanks.
Yeah. I assume you're paying close attention to the craziness that's happening in the election.
I have.
Period.
I just got it. These nuts endorsed Bernie for Democratic candidate.
My wife.
I kind of want to reach out to D's Nuts, honestly.
Yeah. Isn't it great though that that's what, like, I mean, every, you always have the old thing about Mickey Mouse, you know, Mickey Mouse was always a candidate, the write-in candidate, but now it's like become so absurd that D's Nuts got 9% of the vote.
In North Carolina. Yeah. It's amazing. That's because, like, you know, I mean, Donald Trump's such a clown. It's shocking to me that I thought that'd be a meme that died out in a week. At the very least, I have Donald Trump to thank for adopting the term my wherever. So,
yeah, I mean, is it
thank
so
you, Donald.
Dumbfounding to you, though, that that Donald Trump, as a woman in America, is has that many supporters right now?
I can't say. I mean, I'm totally surprised, but I shouldn't be.
Yeah, because some of them have to be women, right? Some of the percentage, sure, just the way it plays out, some of them are women actually saying, nope, this is the guy for me.
I just, the level of idiocy that is so widespread sometimes gets pretty depressing. Did you see, like, I don't know if you saw the Target getting rid of the gendered clothing for kids, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm, toys, or at least the sections. And there were, like, all these comments on the Target Facebook page, just like,
yeah,
people like, I will no longer be supporting your store, and I'm taking my business to Walmart. Like, cool, like, way to vote with your dollars. This is like, and the fact that these, like, you know, that political correctness is the crux of, like, Donald Trump. We have to get Donald Crunk if this guy becomes president.
That's gonna be new. I can't wait for that artist to come out.
Oh God. The fact that, like, you know, rallying against political correctness is the crux of this guy's campaign is just like, who's really worried about political correctness tearing down our country's values? Like, it's just like a smoke and mirror show to distract, right, from issues that would actually impact the people who are voting for him.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the many of the supporters of Trump, the ones who aren't like the super wealthy, obvious ones, are people who would benefit from, you know, higher taxes for the wealthy or for redistribution of, you know, federal spending. And their only concern is, like, that we can't, you know, why are we allowing people to use the bathrooms that align with their gender? Like, I don't know. So, yes, I have been following the election.
You don't have a lot of hope for the future, do you?
No, I do. I don't think that Donald Trump will get elected.
Yeah. Well, that is, I mean, we're far enough out. I figure that pendulum, he'll, I don't know, he'll probably, what is the old phrase? Give him enough rope, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. It seems like there's, you know, he's been hanging himself over and over again, and he still isn't somehow in the race. So.
Yeah. Is there anybody out there that you're you think is worth it?
D's Nuts.
Besides D's Nuts, obviously.
No, I went to a Bernie Sanders rally. Yeah. He's got his problems too, but in many ways I think he most closely aligns with my ideas for how our country should run. And I like a lot of what Hillary says. I think it's very likely that Hillary will wind up the Democratic nominee, in which case I might just vote for Jill Stein again, but I wouldn't be too depressed with Hillary as president.
What do you think? We put Elizabeth Warren in the race and then it becomes a real battle?
I heard that she is being considered as a VP for Bernie Sanders if he gets the nod, so that would be an amazing ticket.
That would be an amazing ticket.
Yeah.
I guess we'll see. And I don't mean to take away, you know, we've spent all this time talking politics because I'm really interested in what you're saying, but there is a record out there and Foiled Deer, and you guys are promoting it. And it's been kind of...
Yeah, I also have no idea how my bandmates, like, intend to vote or not, so...
But that's always a thing, though, when you're the...
I speak for myself alone.
Yeah, when you're the lead singer, though, you kind of do that. You have that microphone, and they, I don't know, do they have to follow suit? You know, they just have to... it's like, okay, that's who we are.
A lot of times we'll do interviews with all four of us, and then it's just like it can get a little convoluted because we do all have pretty different perspectives on at least this realm.
Yeah. Is anybody a Republican in the band?
No, not yet.
Not yet.
We did have like a pretty long car ride recently where this was like maybe a few 3 months ago or something.
Yeah.
Where we were just looking at all the people who were running for Republican. And it was just like the most nightmarish car ride. So we were just, it was like, really, this one? Like, all the worst ones. How's every single worst one running?
Every single one, and they're there. It's there. It's beautiful. This has never happened. It's a beautiful time to watch politics as long as it doesn't result in, you know, the movie, was that Idiocracy or whatever it was called?
Idiocracy?
Yeah, yeah.
If, yeah, we could be eating at Butterfuckers in a 2016.
Outside of politics, I wanted to ask you, did you have a leg up when you said you wanted to become a musician? Because your dad was part of the industry. Your dad was part of lots of different parts of the industry, right?
He did a lot of things. I've kind of refused any of his help in any,
really?
Any sense, and it was to his great frustration.
But it was even knowledge, though, right? I mean, that's something. That's at least...
Yeah, certainly, like, a lot of my desire to talk about and listen to music came from just growing up with him. Like, we had a record player in the house. Like, he would buy 45s to put in it and, tell me what they all were and things that he'd worked on. So I think, like, most of my... And also, like, he played piano, so I took piano lessons as a kid because that was what he did as well.
Right.
So in that sense, yeah, he had a lot to do with me pursuing music. But I also was very full-headed and didn't want too much input.
Yeah.
Which now I'm like...
If you'd wanted it, could he have really helped you out if you had said, hey, I want to do this? I mean, was it that type of a thing?
Not really. He was like, the capacity in which he'd worked in the music industry was pretty peripheral, and he hadn't done it for, I mean, like early 80s, I think he, 81, 82. So any of the like major things that he worked for either have ceased to exist or... Nobody's still working in them. But he had, you know, his friends were more like, he had maintained friendships with some musicians who were, like, pretty notable and interesting to me. Like, he had stayed friends with Lou Reed until, both of them passed away.
Yeah.
And David Byrne was a neighbor. And so I didn't, like, know these people super well, but it would be, like, my dad being like, meet my friend David. And I'd be like, Dad, I don't care who your friends are. I'm trying to do my homework.
And so I see, I'm that kind of dad. Like I've got a, he's almost 8 years old. And I wonder about that. Like, cause I'm like trying to turn him on to all this stuff. And he's, because you think of all the kids rebelling against their parents, you know, I don't want my kid going, oh man, my dad just listened to rock and roll. I've got to do something completely different.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, it's funny. I don't think that like we had too much musical taste in common. So maybe in a way it was, he certainly didn't like very pleasing music.
Yeah.
Which is weird because he had worked for Z Records and like worked with James Chance. So I don't know. Like one of the last albums that we had like a long conversation about was Lana Del Rey. He really, really liked. So it's yeah.
And I'm sure you're really cranking the Lana Del Rey.
Everything. I actually really liked the last album.
The one that came out like what, last year?
Yeah.
West Coast and all that.
Yeah. There were some good tunes on that one.
She doesn't hit with me. I and it's not because I have anything against her. It doesn't land with me.
It took me some time, and a lot of it still grates me. But there's some good tunes on that last one.
All right. I might go back and listen.
You don't have to.
Aside from touring, what happens with Speedy Ortiz from here? I mean, is there a break? Is there an end of campaign and then live your life for a little bit? Kind of.
I had like a pretty secure regular day job that I quit to do this. So it's kind of just like, let's see how much stuff we can do for as long as possible until no one wants to come to shows anymore.
Yeah.
We're sort of in that like survival mode of just, we will do things as long as anyone asks. What's up for us? We have a couple of videos we just finished. So we're going to try to put those out. And we have a couple of, this is like the, speaking of like, tying in politics, we have these covers that we recorded like months ago, but it's like, you know, when you see like bands put out a cover and it gets premiered on a blog, it's like just like an obvious promotional play, you know what I mean? And I'm like, what can we do with these that's like slightly more interesting?
Right.
So we're trying to figure out how to maybe like release them and have it somehow be tied to like donations for a charity. But it's complicated because we don't have the rights. When we've done that kind of thing before, we've had the rights to the song. But on these, like, if we just put it up as a cover, that's fine. That's for use. But if we're trying to fundraise, we have to clear all kinds of things.
Oh.
So that's, like, a thing we're trying to figure out right now.
Takes the fun out of it.
Not really, because if we get to donate a bunch of money to, like, you know, Black and Pink, that would be great for Planned Parenthood. But, yeah, that's, we're, you know, we have these things ready to release. We're just trying to figure out a way to do them that's not totally goony.
Well, good luck on it. I can't wait to
hear. Thank you.
It was really cool to talk to you.
Yeah,
and
you too.
This is one of my favorite records of the year, like without a doubt. So it really is. I'm not throwing that out there as flattery. It's fantastic. So
that's cool. Thank you so much.
Well done, you. All right. Thank you so much, and I'll see you around.
Yeah, thank you, Kyle.
The Skype interviews of 2015 right there. Sadie Dupuy. Okay, now part two. This goes up to 2018. Speedy had just released the LP Twerpverse, and we got to talk about her positive outlook on the state of affairs and monster movies. This is part three of this Rewind episode. Kyle Meredith with Sadie Dupuy of Speedy Ortiz.
Hi, how are you?
Hey, it's good to talk to you again.
Yeah, you too. How are you doing?
I'm well. I want to talk about Twerpverse, the new record, April 27th.
Cool. Shockingly soon.
It is shockingly soon. Well, what, we've heard three songs so far?
And we're not getting any more.
Oh, everything sounds really freaking great so far. I'm excited about the record.
Thank you.
Yeah. Let's see here. You know,
it's nice to live in that kind of limbo when it's like done and you know what it's like and you've got everything planned, but like still get to be at home and no one's like, you know, really heard it yet. It's a nice calm time before the storm of like press and tour.
I'm jumping in that. I'm ruining all of that for you this morning.
Oh yeah, it's really my whole Monday totally shot.
Well, I mean, the three songs I've heard so far, each one of them seems like they are tackling a big issue in a way, but without trivializing or even really being completely specific. Like, there's still a lot of lyrical mystery going on here. Is that something that you wanted to do? Because they're obviously, like, for some people, they're just writing their anti-Trump record, you know, or whatever sure. version of that is. And that's not what this is. This is something bigger. This is something that feels more human, I guess.
I think maybe a signature of this project is that it's never been, I like the expression you just used, lyrical mystery. That seems really fun to me. I've always really viewed getting the lyrics right as like this big puzzle for me and wanting to make sure that they do things that surprise me and that they would be fun to read on the page and not just hear in the song. So while these are, you know, very intentionally big subjects that we're working on this record, I didn't want to lose that sense of play that is sort of inherent to Speedy Ortiz lyrics that makes them so fun for me to write and sing and make album artwork where I'm so excited for people getting to read them written down. So it's a balance of that, wanting to sort of not explore, but really just vent about the things that frustrate me on a daily basis, but also do it in a way that the lyrics could be something interesting to dig into and kind of unpack.
Was there anything, I guess, subject-wise that you had tried to tackle but couldn't articulate in that way?
Well, there's a couple songs that are older that maybe I had written years ago but didn't feel like it was the right timing for me to put a song like that into the world. Like Villain, for example, is from almost 4 years ago at this point, and I had been holding on to this demo for a long time because it just didn't seem like a subject that I was ready to delve into, specifically because it is about harassment and sexual assault. Whereas, like, when I did the Sad 13 project a couple years ago, I did this very positive, celebratory song about affirmative consent, and it seems like consent is much more a part of our national conversation at this point, and it felt like a time that it was okay to release that song, Villain, and that maybe it could contribute something to somebody else.
And as the story goes, I read, I mean, you had started a record. I don't know how far you got into it before kind of saying, that's not it.
We did 11 songs.
Wow.
So we tracked it. We tracked it. We kind of pre-mixed it like four times. I mean, it wasn't just the election, but that was definitely like a final straw where I had sort of been feeling like, I mean, for instance, Villain is from 2014. A number of the songs were sort of from around that time period, written right after the Foil Deer record was done. And while I liked the songs, they just didn't have anything to do with not only like the national context, but like the things that I'm thinking about and worrying about on a daily basis. And it felt like, you know, for whatever reason, putting out a time capsule to put out music from 2014 to 2015 when I just was concerned about different things. And we didn't really want to do something like that. So we went back into the studio in early 2017 and kind of redid the record.
And that's amazing to have to be that far into it. Like, I didn't know you were that far into it. 11 songs tracked,
pre-mixed. Yeah. We're using all the songs that we scratched. So a couple of them, there's like a deluxe. I mean, they're all good. They just, you know, they weren't a record that said anything. And I really like for a record to be its own cohesive thing that has a meaning and, you know, can exist in its own world. And I just didn't think this record, as it stood, said much of anything. So, but we're using the songs for other things. So there's like a bonus 7-inch that comes with the deluxe record, and that has two of the old songs. And for instance, like the Japanese CD will have some of the songs. So Americans will never hear them, but that's okay. Love the Japanese fans too. So they'll go to things like that.
Like I said,
and
I
maybe,
do like
you know, in 20 years, Car Park will do like a, you know, quadruple disc where every B-side gets attached to the record, like Matador style.
Right. Well, like I said, I do like how you're doing it, though. The style, like I said, you know, it's not like, like I said, I didn't hear like the one song. It's like that asshole in office or anything like that. And the timing, I mean, it really couldn't be better because, I mean, the movements, they're not going away after a week like I feel like they used to. I was just randomly listening to, I think it was the Eurythmics, and they were doing Sisters Are Doing It For Themselves, as it was like, you know, her and Aretha. And I thought, you know, here's something, a song about the pay gap. And that was, you know, in the mid 80s or early 80s. And then it just got washed away and everything. And that song maybe sort of became an, you know, a little touchstone or an anthem here and there, but was never able to take root. Whereas I feel like songs like you're writing right now actually have a chance of being part of this bigger conversation.
Yeah, I do think that, I mean, I wouldn't say that that's like specific to our band, but I mean, certainly like a lot of the record is not so much anti-Trump, but it's that's sort of about the horror at this time, and but also celebrating the people who are pushing back against the horrifying things. I think a lot of the record I tried to write about maintaining optimism, and most of the optimism that I feel is from seeing that there are actions in Philly almost every day. Like today there's one about shutting down Starbucks. Like a few days ago there was one protesting the Philadelphia Orchestra because they're performing in Israel. So almost every day there's some kind of action and people are showing up, like hundreds or thousands, you know, thousands of people are showing up. And so I think that, like, as you know, there's plenty to protest, there's also a lot to sort of affirm and see as like useful, productive behavior in shaping a world that can exist the way we want it to. So I think a lot of the record is sort of about that, looking at, you know, who's doing what right and trying to support that.
I love it. I really do. I love the take on it, because I know you're a band. I was seeing the other day with the new video and the, you know, the fish head monster thing, and I think you've written somewhere like, you know, we're a band that's really into monsters. And I thought, well, there sure seem to be a few extra scary ones out there right now if you're looking for them.
Oh, God. Yeah, the metaphors have just come so much easier. We've always done monster videos, and now they really resonate. I will say I was concerned about this interview this morning because normally I'm up quite early, but I said my friend is visiting from out of town, and we watched Paranormal Activity last night, and I became so scared. I'm so scared of it that I slept with the lights on and didn't go to sleep for very long because I was just afraid to. So I'm a little groggier this morning than I normally would be.
It still affects you that way.
Scary movies?
Yeah.
Big time. And I was thinking about it because I can do a horror comedy like nobody else. Like, I love Scream. It's my favorite movie. Just watched Happy Death Day. It was great. If it's like an artier horror movie, like I saw Raw a few weeks ago, that was great. But if it's just like purely scary, I cannot function. And I think that's why we do the music videos sort of as genre movies, because they're closer to horror comedy in the context of a music video than anything actually scary.
Right. There was another aspect of this. You got a new guitarist for this record, and I wondered, how'd that affect the writing for you, if at all?
I wouldn't say it affected the writing, because I think most of it was written before he joined the band. Yeah, but he records on half the record, and everything that Andy wound up on, I think, is much better for it. And the songs that he features on are my favorites of the record. So really, like, I was talking to him about this the other day, because I think something that's challenging for other guitarists who play in this project with me, and really, like, in the Sad 13 project, too, but that's a little easier because on the recordings, it's just me. Mm-hmm. But I overwrite everything. Like, I always have five different intricate guitar parts sort of planned for any given song, and it doesn't necessarily give someone a lot of room to write. So sort of where Andy's role in like these songs, a lot of what he plays almost sounds like a synth, because he's really he got right into the tone zone. He just really came up with interesting tones that would not like fill space, but it just complements so well all of the chaos that is going on in what I'm doing. And then in the parts where I was kind of laying back, he could really shine and do his own chaos. So I think it's challenging to write around me because I write so much. And what Andy's doing really well is, like, he's got amazing tone, amazing texture, and isn't afraid to just like do a simple, quote unquote, simple rhythm that like makes the part. He's got his own project, Laser Background, where he's doing the same thing, like overwriting. There's a million melodies going on all the time. So I think for him, it's like a fun exercise to figure out how to fit into whatever already exists in these songs.
You mentioned that, you know, Sad 13 and that sort of being the point in between the two Speedy records. There are moments on this record, like Lucky 88, when I thought, you know, that seems like a direct line from something that could have happened also in Sad 13 in a way, which is natural when you've got the same songwriter. You know, that's you're going to have those moments or whatever. But, now I wonder if there comes a time when it all sort of starts to be more of one thing, you know, if it has to be separated like that.
I think the big difference is just that there's, like, collaborators in this project. Specifically, like, Mike and Darl. To me, Lucky 88, like, the best parts of the song came from Mike and Darl, our drummer and bassist, respectively. Because I had kind of just come up with this little, like, dinky demo. And I was writing with a synth because I was with my mom for Christmas when I wrote that song. So I had just, like, an OP-1, that little pocket synth. And that was all I had to write with. So I actually, like, wrote almost no guitar for the song when I made and sent them this demo. There's like a couple guitars that I did when I got home, and actually I think any guitar I play on the song was just tracked like in my living room. So I sent it to Darl and Mike, and they kind of, Mike sent me back, like, I keep telling the story, but I think it's so funny because he sent me back like 5 different wave files. He went to his practice space, and I thought he was going to send me back a drum part idea. And he sent me things that were like drum idea 1, drum idea 2, up to 5 drum parts. And I was like, oh, I like, you know, 2 and 4, like, what are you leaning towards? And he was like, no, we're going to layer all of them at once. So I thought that was so cool. He hasn't really, I mean, he's double tracked sections before, but it's never been like, you know, this many interlocking drum parts. And I love that idea of how that song builds. And that was really, truly like Mike's thing. You can hear even on the song, like, there's a little drum machine part that opens up the song. And that was, like, my drum idea that I sent him for the whole song. And he just, like, rightfully dismissed what I had and came up with this awesome thing. And I love what he did. And Darl, same kind of thing. Like, I had sent him just my, you know, playing bass on a synth, like, really simple root note stuff. And I wasn't happy with that at all. And he kind of, Darl is really great for, you know, similar to what I said about Andy, like, sometimes there's so much chaos going on, and sometimes Darl's contributing to that, and sometimes he knows to just do the, like, Kim Deal thing, like, you know, eighth note bass part, doing the root note. Mm-hmm. Kim Deal and the Pixies, I mean, which I think she gave interviews about, like, not overcomplicating the bass. And in this one, Darl did overcomplicate the bass, but in a way that's so perfect. Like, I love what he did on the chorus. So, like, it could never have been a Sad 13 song, because the whole point of that project is not so much that it's synths or drum machines or pop, but that it's just like me working it out at home and not having collaborators. Whereas I'm so thankful to work with these guys and this band, and I don't know, the song would be such a different thing if they hadn't added what they did.
Well, there's a reviewer that I'll have to agree with that said, you know, first listen to that song and it's instantly one of the best rock songs of 2018.
Who said that?
What is that? Maybe
I love them.
I'll co-sign too. Yeah, I'll co-sign.
Oh, I'm gonna have a spring in my step all day.
It is. It's such a catchy song and a really fun one. It's funny though, the first time I heard it, I think I just had the earbuds in or whatever, and I thought you were saying Rocket 88. I didn't look down at the title, and Rocket 88 being like the very first rock song, or, you know, technically speaking or whatever, and I thought, oh, that's interesting. That's interesting. And, you know,
I like that.
Yeah. So it still sort
of worked. Maybe I'll do the thing where, like, live I change the lyrics, which is always a fun time. You know, when you listen to something, I don't know if you have this experience, like, sometimes when I'm listening to my own song, listening back to it, I can kind of hear like the mondegreens that other people will hear, where I'm like, because I didn't enunciate it in the way that maybe translates well. And so when I listen to that song, I'm like, are people going to think it's Lucky Idiot? Like, idiot on my door?
Yeah, there have been some really great moments of misheard lyrics that have, you know, lasted time. So that's... it's not the worst thing in the world, I guess.
Yeah, if we wind up on the right side of a Mondegreen, I'm not going to mind.
I really love the record. I'm so happy, you know, that you're still knocking these out of the park the way they. I always say when you become a fan
Thank
of a
you.
Band, you get really nervous sometimes when the new records come out. It's like, oh God, I hope I love this one as much as the last one.
Will they be terrible now?
and luckily, I love this one just as much as the last one. So that's always the big win right there.
Thanks. I think it's for us. It sounds like a much bigger departure from the first record than the second one does. Like mm-hmm. the second record, we had a lot more time to flesh out, but it still kind of centers that like overdriven guitar stuff, which I still love. And this record does in a way too, but I don't know. We really played a lot more with texture and space, and it seems quite different from the previous two, and I'm psyched on that.
I would agree on it. Well, that's it. So thank you so much.
Oh wow,
it was fun talking.
Yes, you as well.
All right. Well, congratulations. April 27th, Twerpverse. We'll be looking forward to that. I'll talk to you
All right,
soon.
Have a good day.
All right, there we go. Special Rewind episode. Thanks to Sadie Dupuis. Thanks to Kevin Drew. Thanks to you for checking out the episode. Hit that subscribe button before you get out of here so you can keep up with all the interviews that I put out every single week, especially the new ones as well. You can grab us at Spotify, Apple Podcast, NPR, WFPK.org, Consequence, YouTube for the video versions, anywhere you get your podcast from. You can subscribe to Kyle Meredith With, and please do give the series a rating and leave a review while you're at it. After that, you can head over to WFPK.org. where I do a show Monday through Friday starting 6 p.m. Eastern. It's 4 hours of classics from the 80s and 90s. You get the best in new music. There are bonus interviews, lots of music news as well. In fact, one of my recent shows featured some classics and favorites from Tom Waits, Husker Du, Soundgarden, Greg Freeman, Block, Tori Amos, Nine Inch Nails, The Smashing Pumpkins, Prince, Jensen McRae, Bell and Sebastian, Lissy, Nathaniel Rateliff, The Kaiser Chiefs, Lucy Dacus, Rodney Crowell, and my interviews with Devo, Slow Dive, and actor Charles Dance. That's weeknights starting 6 p.m. Eastern at WFPK.org. Consequence has your music and film news. You can also find me on any of the social media sites. The address is always at Kyle Meredith. I do hope you like and follow along. And that does it for another edition. I'm Kyle Meredith. I'll see you next time. Consequence Podcast Network.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.